We've been on the air 65 years. If you believe in what we do, now's the time to support it. Whether you're renewing your subscription or joining us for the very first time, it starts at a minimum of just $5 a month. Way less than a streaming subscription, but far more impactful. This is a membership drive. I'm Ace Estwick, and I serve on KPFK's local station board. Please call 818-985-5735, then press option 2, or visit kpfk.org and click donate now. Let's build the future together.
This is Quetzal Flores from the band Quetzal, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles.
This is the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. The show covers news and public issues affecting areas our students come from, including South and East Los Angeles. I'm Julie Patel-Liss. With Halloween around the corner, I think you'll enjoy some spooky stories from my fall 2024 UT Community News students. But first, an equally scary development these days, artificial intelligence. Cal State LA's library, along with the Asian American Journalists Association and the Latino Journalist of California, hosted a panel recently about machine learning and generative AI. How quickly and deeply it's changing the media ecosphere, what breaking into news and media in the age of AI really means, and more. Let's hear a bit of the conversation with the speakers, John Matsuya, the Director of Content Performance and Analytics at Penske Media Corporation, which owns Billboard, Variety, Rolling Stone, Deadline, IndieWire, and many others. John has over a decade of experience driving SEO, that's search engine optimization, content performance, and AI-powered growth strategies to some of the world's most well-known brands. We'll also hear from Shelby Grad, Deputy Managing Editor for News at the Los Angeles Times. Shelby manages a team that includes the Fast Break Desk, the multi-platform editing desk, and editors overseeing A1, the front page, and the weekend edition. He ran the paper's Pulitzer-winning coverage of the San Bernardino terrorist attacks in 2015, the Bell corruption scandal in 2010, and the San Diego wildfires in 2003. Let's start with your career trajectories. What led each of you to work on issues related to digital news and AI specifically?
Me first, or
sure.
Shelby first?
Yeah.
Great. How many of you have Googled today? Show of hands, almost everyone. How many of you have ChatGPT'd today? Okay, yeah, so this one's a little bit close. I started at Penske Media about 10 years ago, working on SEO, search engine optimization. I worked with all the brands, teaching the newsrooms how to properly format their headlines, how to format their URLs, and how to work in a way where their stories would be the most visible. I recognize Gene Mattis. I don't know if you remember me, but I did train you, or we trained together a long time ago. And as Penske Media has grown, we have worked together with each of those brands over time. Like Julie said, the industry is changing very quickly. In the course of 5 years, SEO as a major traffic channel, I think for every journalist, you understand what channels your traffic, where your readers are coming from. That's what I've been concerned with my whole career. And now we're looking at AI being a mover of your audience and trying to be discovered there. So AI is built on the foundation of large language models, LLMs, and SEO. And so we have been slowly pivoting from just SEO and search engine first, because like Julie said, people might not be Googling as much in 4-5 years. I believe Gen Z starts their search journey at ChatGPT about 50% of the time now. Right. And so if these AI summaries and AI overviews are the ones where the journey starts, we are still invested in having your great coverage, having reporters' coverage be found there, as well as on traditional channels, referral, social, and traditional SEO. So that's where my career has started. It's all been all about evolution. I think anyone who gets into this business knows that It's about finding your audience, evolving with social, evolving with organic, evolving with Google, and now we have all of the LLMs. And so I'm happy to share what we've learned so far and what we're looking at coming up in the next 1, 2, 5, 10 years. What's hype, what's real, how to keep grounded, and how to stay honest and stay true to your core. And using AI as a tool and not as a toy to help your readers find your stories.
Thank you.
Shelby?
Oh, you know, it's great to meet everyone. I started in journalism at the LA Times when the main way you got the paper was just a paper, right? Delivered to you. And it was a really great product, a very successful, made a lot of money off it, and a lot of people read it. And unfortunately, you know, as technology began to overtake first desktop and then with your phone, it really was a really, really traumatic thing for journalism. You know, journalism was much harder to succeed in a place where there was all this competition, and it was much easier to get information more quickly. And, you know, what makes me very interested in AI is because journalists, I think, tend to be a little bit slow to adopt new things. They tend to be a little bit slow in thinking that, you know, technology can do something better than they can. And I think we kind of lost out a lot in some ways in not really being a little bit more embracing of things. And so just to me, AI just seems like it's the next big thing, and really want to help journalists and help the newspaper try to figure out how best to use it and that kind of thing, because I think that's just always changing. And really, I think we're seeing, I think, as we said, is that people are, I think, more like kind of engaged in it now, because I do feel like, you know, this is going to be a big change. I think akin, really, in a lot of ways, to when people started using their mobile apps to get, you know, information. Just really like a big sea change and all the things that change in the way the news cycle worked and the way that you would find information and how much information you can trust. So I think it's a really important moment, and I hope that we're all like going to embrace it and just see how it goes.
That actually dovetails nicely into my next question. And I'm sure each of us could talk hours about this one, but I do think it'll help lay the groundwork. What are journalists' biggest hopes and fears about AI?
I think whenever you fear something, and justifiably so, right, you should learn about it, right? And the more that you do your learning, the more you do your reading, the more you're going to find out that AI is not anything new. We've been using versions of AI, you know, with apps, like Shelby said, or with anything online. But the rate of which it's growing and the rate of adoption is what is, and the rate of its sophistication is what has become a lot more different now. And so continue to learn about it, continue to lean in. I had my existential moment where I think everyone who confronts it looks at it for a second and says, wait, is my job on the line, right? And I think there are a lot of legitimate and justifiable fears. Misinformation, disinformation, the rate that people can create false narratives and fake news, which is what makes journalism and fact-based reporting a lot more important in this time. Google has long had this standing algorithmic factor called EEAT, experience, expertise, authority, and trust. And so as journalists, knowing how to interact with the ecosystem. Do you own your own domain? Have you, even if you don't post on all the social networks, have you already claimed space to your name? Have you already claimed space to any place that you can, just so that you are justified as a person, right? Like, I think what is a little bit strange is all websites have different audiences. For a long time, it was mainly humans and bots. Now it's humans and bots in the form of AI, right? So there's a lot of different things that are ingesting your stories. There's a lot of different people that are reading your stories. But like I said, you have to learn about it. And like Shelby said, as journalists cannot give up on learning the new technology now, or the vacuum is going to be filled with bad actors. I think journalists have always democratized facts and info and honesty and truth. And I think your reporting can still keep some of these very powerful data brokers, AI companies, honest, right? And speaking truth to power and reporting what that reporting on what AI is doing and how they are presenting the stories, right? If AI has quick answers already, are those answers biased? What is being fed into those outputs, right? And also, what kinds of news is being ingested to create that answer, right? So all of those are big questions. For a long time with this EEAT idea, expertise, authority, experience, and trust, we've been trying to make sure that our journalists all have their bios up on their pages, right? We've recently even seen people impersonating journalists. So there is a lot of, it's a brave new world, right? And we have to be ahead of the curve and you have to learn about it so that you understand what is at stake, you understand how to get your stories visible and how to outrank and beat the algorithm.
Yeah. I'm feeling even more anxiety.
I think I should have said something hopeful, right? Like also the hope of this too. I do think that AI though is also a very powerful tool. I've learned so many things using it very recently. Right, I'm not a barbecue person at all, but we had a grill in our lease in our leased apartment, and so I've learned very quickly how to grill things. Right, and so if you use AI, if you use ChatGPT or Perplexity as a tool, it can be a very powerful factor. So using it as a tool for journalists and thinking through at Penske Media how we're using it to help accelerate your writing. I think every job is made out of tasks, right? There's tasks that are annoying, there's tasks that are time intensive, and there's tasks that are core to who you are as either an artist. An artist draws, right? Or a musician plays or writes music. A journalist reports the truth, right? And so understanding what the core is, what you cannot take away from AI. AI has never loved another person. AI has never been afraid of their job going away, right? And so understanding what is core to the job at hand, and then what tasks can you abrogate? What tasks can you give away, right? Like, are you spending too much time renaming all of your files? Is that better spent is that better spent reporting, right? Those are some of the things that at PMC, from brand to brand, we're thinking through how to make the workflow a lot more fast, a lot more simple. How do we eliminate annoying, time-intensive tasks? And how to try to keep the core of what a journalist does, right, which is report, which is find facts, which is break news, right? And that I don't think an AI can do.
Oh, yeah, I would just say, you know, if I was a journalist thinking about AI, I would, you know, there are a lot of things that AI is going to do that could make your life hard, make it hard to make a living in this business. There's no two ways about it. But I'd like put that aside, and we could talk about all the ways it could be bad, and think about what it can do to help you, because I think that that's the most important thing you can do with AI right now, is that AI is going to just have a lot of things they can do to make you a better journalist, to make you a better writer, to help you glean information that seemed impossible to glean. You know, it's already happening, and so I'd say the first thing I would recommend doing is just learning it, like signing on to them, beginning to play around with them. It's kind of, as he said, to really figure out how it can you can use it to make your job more about the journalism and less about sort of little things. But I think really also begin to look at, you know, why is AI sort of such a big deal right now? Well, it's a big deal because it really can help you with decision making, right? It's another tool, whether you're a doctor trying to see whether something on this little screen is cancer or not, or whether it's sort of like a scientist trying to figure out some way to build something, it's another tool that you can use. And journalism is the same thing. And so I would really encourage you guys to look at it. When I write something, I always put it into AI and ask them, hey, summarize this. I'm curious, like, what AI thinks this is at its core level. And sometimes it's kind of shocking how the things I'm trying to say are not actually the things it sees. That's just something worth thinking about. A lot of times I will put like a really long thing that I just like need to like, I would normally scan, but I don't have like, you know, scanning is really not a great way of learning something. I just throw the whole thing and say, summarize this in 200 words. And like, you know, sort of things like that, you know, there are a lot of databases that are already out there that are really incredibly helpful. There's one that I think anyone can get access to called Digital Democracy, which is this site that has pulled in massive numbers of California bills, California laws, California hearings, and it's this amazing way they use AI. It's a partnership that involves the Cal Poly San Luis Obispo that you can go in there and you can really find incredible amounts of information about things you want to write about. You can find all the hearings that were talked about them, and you find shocking things. You know, you say, oh, gee, who, like, something terrible happened, some bill didn't pass, or some terrible bill did pass. How is that ever actually, like, passed? And you could actually go to the lobbying efforts 20 years ago that made it happen. You realize, wow, this is really, so there are a lot of things you can do that's really good. I think one of the things we're really excited about in journalism is the ability for AI to take vast amounts of public information, whether it's city council meetings, school board meetings, massive files, that and give you some sense of what's in them to help your journalism be better, right? Because we are in a world where there are, the need for journalists is much bigger, the number of journalists much smaller, and seeing if the that. And so I would try to kind of not be binary about it and to say, okay, let me focus as much as I can on what it can do to help me and what it can do to help me make better decisions, to help my journalism, and, you know, not be blind to the many ways it is going to really make making a living in journalism harder, because that's, there's no question it is. And I think that's really what's the exciting part is about it, and really kind of using it as a tool. I think there are a lot of things about AI that you have to be really suspicious of, and we can talk a little bit about that. But you can just see how they are just incrementally, week by week, month by month, becoming embedded in the most basic parts of journalism, right? Right now, I think AI is its most used as summarization, right? You know, can you take something you've written that's very long and have it summarized? You know, I think that there is going to increasingly be, over the next year or two, you know, your favorite websites, they're going to start giving you a website a lot more based on who you are. Like, if, you know, if Teresa really is interested in the Dodgers and LA politics and, you know, movies, she's going to start getting a homepage that is very leaning into that. And if I'm into something totally different, you'll be, you know, the things that AI can do to personalize things to make your life better. And those are, most of those things are good things. And I think that as long as you go into it open-minded, I think you can do it. And, you know, it's, I think then you can have that experience of learning about it, seeing how it can help you, seeing how it can make your work better and have you do better journalism, separate from all the anxiety you have over, is this going to take my job? Is this going to take my work that I should be paid for and basically like steal it from me? Those are all real legitimate things. But since you can't really do a lot about that, I think one of the problems we had with technology over the last 30 years, people in journalism, is that they always kind of thought that the work they did was important and good enough that it wouldn't, that they somehow, readers would want to, or viewers would want to stay with it the way it was. They'd still want to watch the 5 o'clock news. They wouldn't want to actually get that video somewhere else, or they would always want the paper, and that they're, oh no, why would you go on to your, sign on to your Microsoft account and go on and watch, read the news on it, on a big monitor when you could go to the paper? I remember I wrote a story last year about 1999 and the LA Times, and I was shocked to see how many people, even back then, which was actually when almost everyone had a PC, how many people thought that, like, oh no, the paper is just so sacrosanct, no one would ever want to give up a printed paper, right? And so I think kind of being a little less, like, you know, sort of sure that the way you do things right now will always be the way to end it, and be open to that. But we could definitely talk about a lot of things that would be bad about AI, because there would be a lot of them. But I think that since we can't really do a lot about that, using them to learn and to really sort of like really try to think, like, let's say I'm trying to do a story about something and I'm one person and I really can't, if I'm trying to find, like, for example, we were thinking about doing a story about, I noticed a little story the other day about how, oh, fire engines now cost $2 million. You know, each fire engine is $2 million. And like cities say, I can't afford, because they're so expensive, they're only made by one company. I thought, well, gee, you could just do that one thing. But what if you like somehow were able to use AI to go through every city council agenda in California and see how many times they have there's been an issue about how long, how expensive these $2 million fire trucks are? And what if you then were able to then use AI to see, did they reduce the number of fire trucks they built or they bought because they were too expensive, and that affect like how safe it was? You know, you could imagine eventually sort of doing all those things. And that's something that could like really be a great thing that you could never do if you had to go to each city, get their agenda and figure it out that way. So I think there's a lot of good things, a lot of bad things, but a lot of good things.
I think the echo chamber problem, though, like of having a personalized website, because social media already does that. Mm-hmm. So that kind of speaks to one of the fears. I mean, people are, you know, so social media can right now make the information you receive so narrow that you're not getting information that would challenge your beliefs and things like that. So, but anyway, and that just points to the need for regulation. I mean, there needs to be more civics classes and more, you know, media literacy at all levels of education. But anyway.
I did have one thought about that, though. If you've ever seen an AI response in ChatGPT, every once in a while you'll see that some of the outputs are a little less radical. So they may give you two sides, or they may say, like, well, you did think about this, but did you look at it from this point of view? Right? I would challenge you to try to enter a story, right, and see if it gives you an answer that asks you to look more broadly. So I'm not a very hopeful person temperamentally, but I did think to myself, you know, is there a world in which in search engine optimization, you were trying to get the first position, right? 33% of your readers would click on that first position back in the day when it was the first thing that they'd see on your phone, right? What if that was a bad actor, right? What if that first position was was misinformation? They just knew how to game the system. They just knew how to write their headlines properly, right? Make sure that their website was fast, right? Make sure that they could get to that first position, right? Now, the optimistic part of some of the outputs is I've noticed that ChatGPT-5 specifically will say, like, well, that was a take that you had there, but what do you think about this version? Or so I have seen somewhat of a de-radicalization in that space, but I think these are all prompts, right? Like what you used to type into your phone, they used to be just keywords, right? One or two keywords, but now keywords equals prompts, right? And you're asking it, and it's trying to bend to what you are what you are inputting into the AI system. Right, I like to think of it as an overeager intern, right? So this overeager intern really wants to help answer your question. And sometimes they don't know how to answer the question, but they're going to say they know anyway, right? That's where the hallucinations come from, right? And so, like Shelby said, please be skeptical. You must remain skeptical about every output that comes out. You must ask it questions. You must keep prompting it to make sure that that the answers. Sometimes they're making it up. Sometimes they don't know, right? To demystify, Arthur C. Clarke, the famous sci-fi writer, said that anything that's technologically advanced will seem like magic, right? So for us, it seems like magic, but this is just pattern recognition. It's just predicting based off of the words that you input, right? The vectors, the queries that you input into your space, what the next word is going to be, right? And that could be extremely problematic. Right, like if doctor always equals man and nurse always equals woman, right, which was the case in previous LLM models, right, that's extremely problematic. So we need journalists to have a different take to start to keep feeding. At Penske, we're kind of in a rock and a hard place. Do you try to get visibility on your LLMs and have them potentially crawl your site, or do you try to keep them at arm's length and make sure that people come to our own and operated, right? And that, I think, is the struggle that all publishers are having. If you're on Google, you've seen the AI overview probably pop up, right? Some of you probably just ignore it. I know a lot of people ignore it and go to the other links, right? But sometimes they're really straightforward, right? They're really easy. You want to know the conversion from the dollar to the yen, it's right there, right? You want to know what time it is in Cleveland, it's right there. So, you know, sometimes it can be very helpful, right? Because the bias that they have is towards speed of your answer, not the accuracy of your answer. Not the specific of your answer, right? So the reason why I think people are going to adopt this is because it's so fast. It's so fast and it's so convenient, right? And I think people always choose the fast, convenient way. So that's why I think that this is where we're already here. We have to grapple with that, and we have to be prepared, and we have to learn about it, and we have to know how these LLMs operate, and journalists have to. So that you can call them out when they keep referring to doctor as man or woman as nurse, right? Or if they keep reinforcing preconceived biases based off a corpus of history that they're using from 2,000 years that's flawed, right? That could be anti-feminist, anti-person of color, that could be unequal, right? So that's where... I wish that a lot of these LLMs would have some sort of nutritional value guide that you would have on food. Where are you getting this information? Right? And that's where a lot of publishers are pushing LLMs to include their sources. Right? You used to go straight to the source, but now sources are a footnote. And I think that the question that a lot of publishers are grappling with is this a David Foster Wallace novel where people are going to read the footnotes, or are we not, like how do we elevate this?
Absolutely, thanks. And yeah, not to mention how major tech companies are taking content from our newsrooms, monetizing it, and not paying these newsrooms. There has been some regulation over that, but some policies and programs are hopefully still in the works. So if you agree with that's not okay, you can make a quick call or write a short email to your state and federal lawmakers. Anyway, you guys have already touched on this, but what are journalists in your newsrooms, the content creators, the writers, editors, the photographers, video and audience people, how are they actually using AI right now in your newsrooms? And then the second part of the question would be, do you have a newsroom policy on AI?
We're kind of in the early stage of using it. There's some AI, mainly, I think, for summarization right now of stories. I'd say the AI is still the kind of thing, the technology is something you have to really check. It's a great guide. It can be an incredibly helpful guide. I think we're already seeing, just in our less than a year of using it, some both great things about it, but also some real red flags about it. And I would say that the biggest one, I think, is that it's not completely accurate. You know, even when it takes a story that we've written, you can, when you look at the way it summarizes it, it has a few kinks that are pretty concerning if you care about accuracy. One is, it has a tendency to conflate like a complex series of things. So if this happens, this happens, this happens, this happens, it tends to usually try to condense two of the steps, and which can create an inaccuracy. It has a serious problem with attribution. It tends to sometimes take something that is attributed to something that, like, the attribution is the difference between being sued for libel or not, and it, like, doesn't put the attribution because it's trying to simplify something. And the third thing that I think is a real concern is really probably, in my opinion, the worst concern. A lot of the AIs have very serious sycophancy problems. They tend to make them more marketable. They tend to be lavishing on praise of everything you give them. It is always encouraging you that you're right, that your way of looking at it is good, that... And that comes sometimes at the extent, of being accurate. You know, that's a major problem with AI, and I think it's one that is kind of becoming a crisis. There's been some reporting last few months that a lot of the AI companies are really trying to go back and work on the sycophancy problem. There was a really great story in the Wall Street Journal I encourage you to read about a man, a very disturbed man, a former tech executive who kind of went crazy, and he communicated for months just with an AI app, and he kept telling this AI app more and more crazy things. and the IAAP to be sycophantic, kept saying, oh, you're right. You're not crazy. That's a really good point. Led him to kill his mother. And this is all like now people are this they got access to all his chats. And it was really shocking to see sort of like how AI, because it's designed to make you its friend, they want you to be your assistant. Wonder when we're writing ourselves, is this any good? And, you know, they are leaning into making you feel like it's really good. And so you have to be very careful about that. So I think it's a thing that can be a huge help. I think if you, for journalism, you have to really say, it's a thing I need to check. AI is increasingly being used to publish stories, you know, like, you know, stock stories. You know, you know, someone puts out a quarterly thing, the AI will present a three-paragraph thing that will go up there. You know, there are whole websites now that just do that. You know, they process quarterly reports and they put them up there. The LA Times, the pioneer in that, we had what they called the QuakeBot, which would scrape, when there was an earthquake, it would scrape the data from the USGS, and this is like 15 years old, and produce a story without any human saying the thing was there. We got in trouble once because there was a error that said that there was a 6.5 earthquake in Santa Barbara that we published even though no one felt it, which is a whole other thing where the error, the human error was R is for not saying, well, gee, if there's a 6.5 earthquake in Santa Barbara, we probably would feel it in downtown LA. But anyway, so I think that that's what I would just say. It's a great tool, really, really great tool, but it's something that can be a guide to what you do as opposed to a real thing, you know, because there are really issues with it. But I do think that it's going to get better and better, and I think you will begin to see more content, quote unquote, that is just produced by AI. And, you know, at some point it might be something that you could trust more. I think that right now it's still a little bit a work in progress, but yeah.
I wish I brought this graph. Maybe I'll post it on LinkedIn. But there is a list of things that AI does really well right now, and there's also a list of things that AI does very poorly right now. Now, that is evolving very quickly, right? Like, some things that it was doing poorly previously was math, right? You wouldn't think that simple math would be something that it couldn't do well, but sometimes you'd be in Excel and you'd say, like, wait, is this actually adding up to this? And I caught myself because it says it with such authority, but it's predicting, right? It's predicting patterns. So it didn't do math very well. That has changed. But there are still things that it does really poorly, right? Like human sensitivity or empathy, right? And there are very many things that it does well. How we're using it in the newsroom. To start, we're looking at security first, right? We don't want it to train on things that are our background or our private. We want to make sure that anything that we are exercising with an LLM is not being trained on, and it's not visibly accessible to the public or to the AI company itself. So there's a lot of testing as it comes to these tools. A lot of these tools are fundamentally flawed. Right, I've tested about 50 of them, right, trying to figure out good use cases for our newsrooms, right? A shiny new WordPress plugin comes out and it promises the world, and it can't do that much because it can only train on things that it already knows, whether it has a huge corpus of information like Google. If it's an enclosed space, right, which is a small language model, right, I think that those will probably become more and more popular within businesses, within newsrooms, within what we're tentatively encouraging right now is the use of a small language model for style guides, right? At Billboard, we've worked with style guides for artist names. Like, we created a custom chat for an artist name style guide. So if Charlie XCX changes the way that her name is pronounced or spelled in the middle of Coachella, then from now on, it will correct you that this is the way that you use her name now, right? And you don't really have to think about it. There are now much more advanced proofreading plugins. The whole industry of SEO, where I started, is changing, where you can find out headlines that have been tested, right, and that you can incorporate. I really like using AI to ask for more sources to validate the work that you've done or ask for more ideas with the story. There's a lot of times where visibility means that you want to be targeting a word count, or that you want to be targeting proper context. You might still be wanting to rank first. So asking it, are there other great sources that I could use to validate the story? right? And I think Ezra Klein said this, but he never uses the AI model for a first draft, and he never uses it for a last draft, right? You want to have it as a co-intelligence somewhere in the middle of your workflow, but AI is not going to tell you when you're wrong or when your first draft is fundamentally off the mark or if there is something that you need to dig in on, right? And if you don't have it ready for a final draft, if you're using it for a final draft, you may come up with incorrect information, right, without a human reader. So those are a couple of the ways that we're using it.
And I would just add on that in investigative reporting, we've been using AI for a long time. Tools like Google Refine. I used that like in 2012. Basically, when you get a lot of data, it helps you clean the data. So, for instance, when we received more than 100,000 rows of campaign finance data for a public radio project, but it was too messy to analyze. Addresses weren't consistent, some were missing the city, or some roads said Boulevard spelled out while others said BLVD. Once you clean the data and do spot checks to avoid errors, AI-powered tools in Excel and Google Sheets can help you recognize patterns and quickly pull out subgroups of data to analyze.
In the next 2 or 3 years, you may not even need formulas anymore. Your formula is equals GPT, and then you write in a prompt, right? And say, like, you know, figure out all of this stuff for me, and it will understand that. So, you know, there's places within analytics and business intelligence where it will advance a lot more quickly. And for journalists, it might give you more insight on the data that you're using, right, without having to use a formula.
Exactly. And it helps with those bad PDFs we get from public agencies sometimes. There are some good free software programs that allow you to upload the PDF and it'll spit out a spreadsheet for you. Though, obviously, you still have to spot check and fix a lot of the data depending on how bad the PDF is. And we as professors also use AI in our classes. Generally, the policy is no AI can be used except when you're with a professor doing it for a very strategic reason or assignment. So, for instance, I've had my students put in their reporting from different sources, put in the quotes, and then the AI tool will help them look for themes or subtopics. And that's been very useful. And Shelby's idea about using AI to provide reporters with notes from various council meetings. And yeah, if we can get all of those council minutes into a searchable archive, you'd see patterns in public issues you've never thought about before. Things that need to be covered and that may be affecting a lot of people across an entire state or multiple states. To ease anxieties for my students about AI, I tell them that there's an important place for news judgment, like what stories to cover, who to interview, what data and records to get, analyzing all of that, and the critical thinking that goes into it. Knowing your audience, what they care about, how to make a public issue more engaging. And also, powerful storytelling still matters. Who but humans can write stories that are so good they make you cry and laugh and make you feel something?
There's an art to writing, right? There's an art to writing and there's a pleasure to reading. So retaining that and inspiring that, and that's going to be what we all need to do.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Shelby, so much for your insights today. They were super helpful, and I hope the audience finds them helpful, too. I also want to thank the groups that sponsored this event, the Asian American Journalists Association, LA Chapter, CCNMA, Latino Journalists of California, and the Cal State LA Library. And of course, the event is in honor of Randy Hagihara, a former LA Times editor and recruiter. You are listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. After the break, get ready to be spooked with true personal stories from our students. Stay with us. We're back to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Julie Patel-Liss. It's October, and to get you in the mood, let's hear some scary stories. Last fall, I asked students in my UT Community News class to write about a real scary or spooky or paranormal experience that they've had. But it had to be true, a real story. As an example, I shared with them a kind of spiritual moment from my own life. Here it is. My grandma lived in India, over 7,000 miles away from where I grew up, Chicago. but I was closer to her than I am to most of my friends and family. I think it's because when I was with her, I got the sense that she really loved me. It was the small things, the way she hugged me, held my hand, looked at me. She'd make sure I got the best foods when I visited. I felt very loved in her presence, which struck me as odd because I only saw her every 3 or 4 years. How could she love me so much when I was so far away and she rarely saw me? My grandparents had been married over 50 years, most of their lives. So after my grandfather passed away in 2007, when I was 29, I knew I had to visit my grandma. I stayed with her for a few weeks. We did all the usual things we'd do on my India trips. I went for a run or slept in while she sweetly and devotedly read parts of the Bhagavad Gita. She was a true scholar of the holy book, in the cutest and humblest way. We ate 3 home-cooked meals a day, plus giant snacks. We napped. I asked her about my mom and her siblings. We watched Indian television at night. I massaged her calves, which were always in pain. When I was leaving for my flight, I gave her the longest hug. I knew it could be our last. We both cried. About a month later, my relatives called to say she died, and my mom and I wouldn't make it there in time for the service. I was devastated. I cried for so many hours that I felt dehydrated, and my face and eyes were puffed up for hours. Then a few nights after her death, I had the most vivid dream. She was in it, and I don't remember much now except the hug. It was the longest, warmest hug, a hug that gave me a feeling of truly being loved. It didn't feel like a dream. It felt real. It felt like her goodbye to me. It felt so real that after a lifetime of not believing in the supernatural, I believe that was her, in ghost, spirit, or some other form. That was my story. Now, here's a similar experience by recent Cal State LA grad Haley Mosley, as read by my youngest son, Eitan Liss.
I grew up in an apostolic church where we strongly believe in both good and evil spirits, in the power of God and the influence of Satan. It's a world where faith is not just practiced, but felt deeply, where prayer is our lifeline to God, and our community leans on it daily. One woman in particular, Sister Sanders, was what we called a prayer warrior. She was known for her deep spirituality, always seeking a connection with God, constantly praying for others, and standing strong in her faith. After Sister Sanders passed away, I had a dream that left a long-lasting impression on me. In this dream, I found myself on a ship with her family. As we sailed across, I looked across the waters and saw another ship passing by. On board was Sister Sanders, calm and peaceful, waving at me. Her face looked serene, as if she was simply moving on to the next journey. The sight of her gave me a sense of reassurance, as if she was letting me know that she was safe and at peace. Then something happened. I felt a touch on my shoulder that woke me up. I didn't feel any fear. The energy in the room felt light and comforting, like a warm embrace. I felt sure it was Sister Sanders' spirit visiting me. I took it as a way of her saying goodbye, letting me know that she was okay and at peace with God. That experience brought me a new sense of closure and deepened my faith, reminding me that those who walk closely with God are never truly far from us, even after they're gone.
Thank you, Haley and Eitan. This next story is written and told by Cal State LA journalism student Emmanuel Martinez Melendez.
The weird men that walk around the neighborhood, the abandoned ranch owner's home that was haunted, or even a mountain lion that ran rampant in the forest-like park in the city. Growing up, we always made up these detailed rumors to spook each other. However, my experience still feels real to this day. It was a Saturday in the fourth grade when I was spending the day over at my second aunt's house and often spent time with her youngest son, my cousin Alan, who was a year older than I was. Most of the time, we would either play video games inside or run around the apartments and the small neighborhood park with the other kids. That park became the core of a vicious rumor that quickly became a reality for me. "She always sleeps there when it's dark in front of the bushes, man," Alan would always tell me. He got this information from the other kids we would play with. "I heard she even has a small gun," he continued, as he could tell he was starting to spook me. Alan was getting to me, and it showed. In the back of my mind, is a lady with a gun who sleeps in the park at night real? I had to be brave, though. I had to keep up a nonchalant act, even if I was starting to sweat a little. I couldn't show my cousin I was a wimp. And the girl I liked lived in this neighborhood, too. What if word got around that I believed in this and got scared? But I got spooked. So I made up the excuse to use the restroom, which was partially true, but I didn't need to go that bad. I left my cousin and the other kids at the park during the evening. The sun was still up. I was already halfway to the second story apartment they lived in when I had a change of heart. I have to go back to them, or else they're going to think, yeah, I don't need to use the restroom. I did a quick 180 to run those couple of yards back to the park when I immediately stopped in my tracks as soon as I turned. Her face was heavily wrinkled. Her blue scarf covered her head, so her white bangs were the only visible part of her hair. Her face was so wrinkled I couldn't see the color in her eyes, if she had any color, that is. Her clothing was ragged, and she had a walking stick in her right hand. But I wasn't focused on her right hand. On her opposite side, I saw a glisten, a shine I was all too familiar with growing up in the neighborhoods that I did. The shine in the hands of the men who drove by certain streets and took lives away. The shine in the hands of men who frequently robbed the 7-Eleven right behind the apartment complex we were in. The same shine in the hands of the men who had stopped them from doing so many times. It was taken care of, which means she had to use it a lot, or had to mean a lot to her. Her dead stare came from yards away. I knew exactly who she was looking at. Do I call for help? I could hear the sounds of Alan and the other kids blissfully playing in the park. Did they not see her walk by? No. If I called their names out, would she get to them first? I didn't want them to get hurt, no matter how annoying they were. I looked slightly to my right for a half second, never stopping eye contact with her. 5 steps, and I was on the stairs. Could I make it? The stairs were covered completely, and it was an escape if I was fast enough. I would have cover, but my heart had dropped completely. It felt as if I wasn't there in the first place. The sunlight landed perfectly on her left hand, making it more apparent that my intuition was correct as she slowly started to walk. I wasn't going insane. Left foot, right foot, stick. Left foot, right foot, stick. I had no choice. I ran as fast as I could, and to this day, I've never run faster. In about what felt like 2 seconds, I had run up the 2 sets of stairs and knocked ferociously on my aunt's door. ¡Abre la puerta! I yelled. As my aunt opened the door in a rage, I fell to the floor and quickly got up. Then, I ran to the balcony. What if she chose to get to my cousin because she couldn't get to me? I quickly dove and looked through the hole beneath the balcony. Nothing. She was gone. The leaves around the area where I saw her standing showed signs that she had been there. And most of all, there were footprints exactly where she was standing. However, that patch of dirt was right in front of the sidewalk, so there wasn't a trail. But where did she go? That didn't matter. My clothes were drenched, and my heart was about to explode out of my body. That night, when my father picked me up and we had to walk by the same park to get to the visitor parking, I made him walk on the sidewalk opposite of the parking lot with me. And I continued to do the same thing every night for the following year. I did not want to disturb the lady of the park ever again. That was a true personal story by me, Emmanuel Martinez, for UT Community News.
Thank you, Emmanuel. Now let's hear a story by recent Cal State LA grad Thomas Davila, as read by my oldest son, Davash Liss. Thomas has spina bifida, which has led to many difficult moments in his life, and he's written about it eloquently for the Community News section of the University Times.
At only 41 years old, I faced death more times than I care to remember. I've stuffed myself in a dresser drawer, been buried alive, almost crushed by a watercraft, not to mention the 24 times I've gone under the knife. The last one isn't so bad. Now that I'm older, it becomes part of who I am. Having to get cut open when you're a little kid will scar a normal person for life. It scarred me, not only because I went through it, but I remember the details of everything that occurred when I knew that I would be having surgery. I was fighting and fighting with the anesthesia mask covering my little chubby mouth. Doctors always give patients the talk before surgery. The talk includes them saying that there's a small chance that something could go wrong while you're asleep and that you could die. A child should never have to hear that. Knowing that you could die from something that is supposed to help you can screw up a child's mind. It's been more than 40 years since my first surgery, and they're still telling patients that there's a chance they're gonna die. Death is scary. It's bound to happen sooner or later. It's a part of life. It's not something a kid should have to face, at least not alone. Being at peace with knowing that I will die one day is something I can handle. What I can't handle is the when. That is scary.
I wholeheartedly agree, Thomas, and thank you for sharing your story. You've been listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. Our executive producers are my colleague April Brown and me, Julie Patel List. Our theme music is Contagious by Mark Varg. Special thanks to our other Cal State LA journalism faculty members, Tony Cox, Joanne Lightford Powell, Chanel Curry, Andrew Campa, Julian Reyes, Libby Lewis, and Nithin Patel, and TVFM Department Chair Michael Clark, Associate Chair Christina Hackle, staff members Eliel Beltran, Jeff Fust, and Jesus Cruz, and all of our TVFM faculty members. There are too many to list them all, but you all are important contributors to our program and department. I'm Julie Patel Liss. From all of us at Cal State LA, thank you for listening. We'll be right back.
Good morning and welcome to the Cal State LA Community News Hour. My name is Maggie LaPeak, and I'm here to help support the station. The Cal State LA Community News Hour airs the first Sunday of each month at 10 a.m. It has been on our airwaves. You can put the music back on. That would be great, Ozzy. And it has been on air for more than just a little. It's okay. It's a Sunday morning, and we're just all kind of waking up and getting ourselves together. But just a little bit about the Cal State LA Community News Hour. It has been on air for more than 3 years, since July 2022. The show features stories by Cal State LA student journalists from the largely undercovered areas of the East Side and South LA that they live in, which is why they often find stories others don't. Most of the show's contributions come from the UT Community News Class, a Cal State LA news outlet that covers neighborhoods and small cities on the East Side and Southeast LA County. Other contributions largely come from the interviewing, podcasting, investigative, and capstone classes. So since 2022, we've been partnering with the students at Cal State LA and bringing you student stories that focus on mental health, LGBTQ plus rights, and other social issues, as well as student-produced work that offers lessons and, you know, compassion and hope for listeners. And I'm urging you to call and support this type of programming. Call us right now at 818-985-5735, option 2. Pledge $25, $50, $100. How about if you become a sustainer for as little as $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever you are comfortable with. The main thing is to support these young voices and stories that you hear on KPFK the first Sunday of the month from 10 to 11 a.m. Now, the rest of the time, you have the phenomenal and the legendary Susie Weissman and Beneath the Surface, who is probably one of the longest-running shows on KPFK. She's been with us for at least 4 decades. An amazingly amazing journalist in her own right, so dedicated to this radio station, and we love Susie Weissman. And she's made space for the Cal State LA Community News Hour just once a month, the first Sunday of the month, 10 to 11 a.m. Show your support of that right now by dialing in 818-985-5735, option 2. I'd like to get 5 callers before the top of the hour in support of these wonderful students. And speaking of students, in studio with me is our Sunday morning engineer, Ozzy Flamenco. And Ozzy came to us some years ago via LA Valley College. And he was a volunteer with us for a while, and one of the greatest volunteers ever. I mean, I just loved him. I'd say to Ozzy, I need help doing this or an event or production work, whatever it was. Ozzy was there on the spot, willing to help. And this is the importance of students and KPFK, which KPFK has traditionally been a home for students for learning, training, developing skills, and so forth. So then some years later, Ozzy came back and's like, yo, I'm graduated now, and I'm ready, like, maybe to work. So we brought him on and hired him as a part-time board operator, and he's doing some traffic work, and he's doing an amazing job. And Ozzy, I just wanted to ask you, you know, why you think, and you know firsthand, why it's so important to have students involved with the station.
One word, service. And that's really what I pride myself in, is being able to give back to a station like KPFK. And as a student, you learn everything you want, you know, so you can do better. And I appreciate the opportunity, like an independent station like KPFK, that has given me the opportunity to show off my skills and hone in. So it's a great opportunity right now to help us out, you know, be a sustainer. Call in right now, pledge at 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. And yes, Maggie, I'm so thankful for the opportunity that I get to work with you, general manager at the moment, and doing big things for KPFK. So again, support KPFK, an independent station that's here for you, that's here for students, you know, just like me.
That's right. And thank you so much, Ozzy. And KPFK is licensed as an educational broadcaster, and we educate not only the listeners with our broadcast, but traditionally things have been a little bit different since we, you know, in a temporary space. But we traditionally provide in-house training for members of the community, particularly students. So if you support that, please call us right now, 818-985-5735, option 2. Put that on your Visa, MasterCard, American Express, Discover. Support this type of programming with a $25 pledge, a $50 pledge, whatever you're comfortable with. But we really are looking for sustainers. And that way, we can just have money coming in every month, as little as I'm a sustainer, by the way, Ozzy, for just $5 a month. And I'm thinking about upping it up to $10 a month because I'm going to get rid of one of my streaming services that I'm now using. So I thought, why not? You know, I can go from $5 to $10.
Take a break. Take a break from all those subscriptions.
That's right.
And do something good for us. Support KPFK.
And that's the thing, is that we have all these streaming services, and I kind of have to evaluate them and think, am I really watching them? No, not really. So that's why I need to actually do a little bit more. But a little more about the Cal State LA students. They bring important perspectives and stories to the local news ecosphere. Depending on the year, the cohort, about 65-75% of the journalism students at Cal State LA are first-generation college students and Pell eligible, which means, you know, for the grants. Their household incomes are at or below the poverty line. And as the only CSU in the city of Los Angeles, our students represent the rich diversity of the city. So, and we work directly with Cal State LA professors, Julie Patel Liss, who we hear from every week, and April Brown. They edit, and they are lead production of the show, highlighting the content produced by their journalism students. They have guest producers, and hosts include Joanne Lightford, Tony Cox, and of course, the students. The students really are the stars. So, folks, we need you to call in. We've only got about a minute and a half left. And show your support for this program, which airs once a month, the first Sunday of the month, the Cal State LA Community News, first Sunday of the month at 10 a.m. Been on our airwaves since 2022. If you're just hearing it for the first time, or you're hearing me talk about it, check it out. It's really an amazing program put together by the professors, but the stories are by the students. So give us a call, 818-985-5735, option 2, and support this type of programming that is very community-based and involves students, because that's what it's all about here at KPFK. And yes, I'm Maggie LaPique. I'm the longtime music director and promotions director here at KPFK, but currently the interim general manager. And we're trying to do some amazing things here at the station currently, but we can only do it with your support. Right, Ozzy?
That is definitely true. Please call in at 818-985-5735. Press option 2. And that again is 818-985-5735. Press option 2. We need your support. You know, students like myself get the opportunity to have hands-on experience. Not only that, just our morning programming is some of the greatest that you can hear that has no algorithms behind it. So,
fantastic. Ozzy, thank you so much. And let's get back to the show. And we've got background briefing coming up next. Stay with us.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. Join listener-supported KPFK. Call now, 818-985-5735.
It's Raul Pacheco from Ozo Motley. You're listening to KPFK. Support and turn it up.